Chapter 5. Globalists versus Nationalists. Political Fault Line for a New Century. In the absence of justice, what is sovereignty but organized robbery? St. Augustine. History will record that for 8 years at the beginning of the 21st century, George W. Bush was the most powerful person on earth. It is sometimes difficult to make sweeping assertions about who sits atop the pyramid of power in a given human pursuit. In religion, the Pope is undoubtedly the top Catholic, but multiple imams and rabbis also have widespread influence. Rex Tillerson may run the largest private energy company in the world, but as we have seen, he may be less powerful than Saudi oil minister Ali Al-Naimi. Bill Gates may still, by many measures, be atop the information technology world, but today the buzz says Google is hotter than Microsoft on the innovation front, and the field is so volatile that a new technological breakthrough could dethrone the Seattle software mogul at any time. In other words, while it is possible to name the princes of the knowledge economy, crowning a single king is much more difficult. But there is only one commander-in-chief of what is by far the world's most powerful military, and he also happens to be the chief executive of the world's richest nation, one with a GDP 3 times higher than the runner-up, Japan. The President of the United States has extraordinary power to conduct the business of the United States as he or she sees fit, despite the carefully constructed checks and balances provided by the Constitution via the carefully crafted roles it prescribes for America's bicameral legislature and its Supreme Court. Members of the President's cabinet serve at his or her pleasure. Indeed, presidents have the option of changing the structure of the cabinet, of firing and hiring new members, and of determining who serves on influential advisory committees like the National Security Council, the Homeland Security Council, or the National Economic Council. Today, there are more than 3,000 such presidential appointees, a number that has swelled from roughly 600 just 30 years ago. In this way, the president's greater power may in fact be his or her ability to mete out authority to those around him, granting and withholding power. As former Secretary of State Colin Powell said to me, "In our system, it is hard to overstate the centrality of the president. Others advise. The Congress can block. But he is the initiator and the key decision-maker. I've seen presidents who didn't fully realize this even as they were entering office. And often when I read commentaries about what is happening in our government, they underplay the responsibility the president has, either through his actions or through his decisions not to intervene." Bush proved the extraordinary power of his position by deciding to launch a global war on terror and invading 2 countries, without anything resembling a formal declaration of war from Congress. When a U.S. president is joined in office by a Congress controlled by his party, as Bush was for his first 6 years in office, exceptional power is made more extraordinary and, in some cases, virtually unchallengeable. International disapproval of his actions, or even a majority of Americans opposing his policies, cannot stop the occupant of this office in those circumstances. There is no truer measure of real power than the ability to impose one's will on resistant constituents, or, as Bush has done, on a resistant world. This is the George W. Bush administration, one top Republican observer in Washington remarked. Sure, the roles that Vice President Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld played were big, but what they did, what roles they played, how far they were allowed to go, that was ultimately the president's decision, and the outcomes are ultimately his responsibility. The power of the modern president, especially when it comes to foreign affairs, is clearly not what America's founders had in mind. When John Adams observed, "There is danger from all men. The only maxim of a free government ought to be to trust no man living with power to endanger the public liberty." He was articulating a view shared by many of his brethren who shaped the new institutions and laws of the United States in the late 18th century. Indeed, the first impulses of the leaders of the new republic were reflected in the Articles of Confederation, which created only a very weak chief executive, vesting most powers in a single legislative chamber in reaction to what were seen as the abuses of the British monarchy. In this spirit was the American Congress empowered to declare war, approve executive appointments, and cast the deciding vote in choosing the president if no candidate had a majority in the Electoral College. Over time, presidents have asserted their primacy in numerous ways, from the gradual expansion of the executive branch and the budget and thus the influence associated with it, to the modification of concepts such as executive privilege. These moves to consolidate power in what Bush administration officials like to call the unitary executive effectively do what was considered anathema by America's founders, place the president and those in his office above the law by placing them beyond the investigative powers of Congress. For its part, of course, America's congressional leaders have proved themselves to be periodically so capricious, ill-informed, self-interested, partisan, and, not infrequently, much worse in their regard for the law, that presidents have benefited from considerable public support for the expansion of the chief executive's role and prerogatives. Nothing makes for strong presidents like weak legislatures. The power vacuum. The patterns of arrogation of authority by the president and abrogation of responsibility by Congress is not only repeated throughout history, it also echoes patterns that have led to the concentration of political power among the few in the United States, especially when it comes to shaping America's global role. For example, the top job in the U.S. political structure is not actually the president. It is the voter. But voters cede power when they fail to meet their responsibility as citizens to understand and deliberate on the choices before them. About 40% of Americans eligible to vote did not bother to do so in the 2004 presidential elections, and nearly 60% did not vote in the midterm elections 2 years later. According to the 2007 Pew Survey of Americans' Knowledge of Current Affairs, it is clear that many do not take their broader civic responsibilities very seriously either. Only about two-thirds of Americans could even name the vice president. Four times as many Americans could identify singer Beyoncé Knowles as could identify Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. And three times as many could identify Indianapolis Colts quarterback Peyton Manning as could identify Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. Only half knew that religious violence was behind most of the current fighting in Iraq, and less than a third could identify Sunnis as the principal group in conflict with the Shiites in a country that had dominated American headlines for 5 years prior to the polling. Less than a third could name the president of Russia, and only about a third of Americans, according to a Canadian government study cited in The Economist, have passports, suggesting that their preparation for overseeing the greatest power of the global era is sadly lacking. With this kind of base of knowledge, or rather of ignorance, voters either make themselves more easily manipulated, or they simply opt out of the system of government, removing the main check on the power of the president. The fact that most international issues fail to resonate with voters has also given Washington decision-makers a sense that they can conduct their international policy-making essentially within the confines of a small specialist community. This is the abrogation factor at work. Something like one-third of U.S. Congress people and almost two-thirds of their staff don't have passports. Even these full-time professionals in the policy-making community seem to have opted out of being fully engaged participants in shaping America's international role, or they are laboring under the misconception that they can make constructive judgments about America's role in the world without actually venturing out into that world. Four of the five presidents elected between 1976 and 2006 had virtually no major international policy experience. Is it any wonder that the debate regarding the consequences of major international actions is so inadequate, or that those actions seem to be so uninformed by history or an understanding of regional affairs? As one very prominent political consultant said to me, Americans tend to act based on what they believe rather than what they know, and they like leaders who have similar impulses. Into the void created by congressional abrogation come marching those who would influence these issues. Not surprisingly, a group containing a far higher concentration of those with global interests, and one that is able, through other tools of power and influence, to arrogate disproportionate influence to themselves. One such group, the subject of my last book, Running the World, is the international policy community in Washington. This is a very small, tightly knit group of influentials, many of whom have known each other and worked together for most of their careers. The group who have served or are likely to serve in top foreign policy and national security positions, and those who have the greatest influence among them, number no more than a few hundred. Most have attended or taught at a handful of elite universities. To identify a few, former Defense Secretaries Donald Rumsfeld and Frank Carlucci were undergraduate roommates at Princeton. Henry Kissinger and Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski rivaled one another at Harvard. Madeleine Albright's father taught international affairs to Condoleezza Rice. Members of this set typically belong to the Council on Foreign Relations and other groups that link them closer together, and they often work together for administration after administration. Also, as a consequence of their domination in the top U.S. policy jobs, they are the few with the greatest ties to the foreign policy elites of governments around the world, which in turn makes them that much more valuable in Washington. To run for president, candidates need teams of top advisors, not just for advice, but also as validators who can demonstrate the candidate's competence in, for example, international affairs. Not surprisingly, the best validators are those who have held high positions in the past. Consequently, those who have done so are the most likely to do so again. As noted in Running the World, it is one of those communities in which the best credential for entry is already being a member. The result is a highly interconnected group of decision makers and a remarkable concentration of power in a small circle. This power extends beyond the halls of the executive branch. We have seen the influence levied by firms like Goldman Sachs within the top echelons of the U.S. government, but it is worth underscoring yet again the revolving door that allows policymakers to leave top firms to go into government and then to re-enter those firms. This is one way that the financial community maintains its influence. Perhaps it is not surprising that each of America's recent Secretaries of the Treasury has subsequently taken a senior position in the financial world. Former Secretary John Snow at Cerberus. Former Secretary Paul O'Neill advising Blackstone. Former Secretary Lawrence Summers at D.E. Shaw. Former Secretary Robert Rubin at Citigroup. Former Secretary Nicholas Brady at his own firm, Darby Overseas Investments. The reality is that a senior policy job in government is one of the most direct ways to a remunerative position on Wall Street, in the defense sector, or elsewhere in the corporate community. While that might fall into the news from nowhere category, presumably all these individuals must work somewhere after they leave government, it does not diminish the equally important fact that big Wall Street firms and corporations with long rosters of former government officials have disproportionate influence on policy decisions. We need look at only a few examples to get a sense of the impact of this connection between elites in different power clusters. At the time of this writing, Goldman's board includes Stephen Friedman, the former Goldman CEO and current chairman of the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and James Johnson, the former head of Fannie Mae and top advisor to Democratic presidential candidates. Within Goldman, we find a wide variety of former government officials, including, to name a few, the former Undersecretary of State, Bob Hormats, the former Undersecretary of the Treasury, John F.W. Rogers, and the former New York Fed Chairman, Gerald Corrigan. Look at top firms besides Goldman, and the results are the same. The board of Morgan Stanley includes former White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles, former National Economic Council Chair Laura Tyson, and former SEC Chief Accountant Donald Nicolaysen. The board of Citibank, former CIA Director John Deutsch and former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. The board of Lehman Brothers, former Ex-Im Bank Chairman John McComber and former Rear Admiral Marcia Johnson Evans. And perhaps most impressively stacked with former government officials, the board of American International Group, former Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen, former Chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers Martin Feldstein, former U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hills, former U.N. Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, former Chief Security and Exchange Commission Accountant Michael Sutton, and former energy czar Frank Zarb. Of course, the list does not stop at America's borders. The list of international leaders with ties to major financial institutions is a long one as well. Former British Prime Minister John Major joined the Carlyle Group after his term in office, and former Peruvian Prime Minister Pedro Pablo Kuczynski joined Credit Suisse First Boston. I chaired a panel at Davos in 2006 featuring the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Shaukat Aziz, who described during our chat in the green room how helpful his years at Citigroup had been in preparing him for political office. Even with the most assiduous efforts at avoiding conflict of interests on the part of these individuals and the many others who pass through the revolving door between the government and corporate communities, one can see how the worldviews of two such integrated communities must begin to blend together. With such a small group atop America's policymaking apparatus, and such a high likelihood that many of its members will work with the most internationally engaged and highly remunerative business organizations before and or after their tenures, it is clear why the agendas of a few major global corporations resonate at the most rarefied levels of the U.S. government. This, then, is among the forces that fill the void created by the ignorance of the American public and many of its elected representatives. And it produces direct results, one of which is legislation that is overly favorable to financial institutions. To choose one example that was controversial at the time of this book's writing, private equity firms managed to persuade Congress to treat their carried interest in companies as capital gains rather than ordinary income, resulting in a substantial tax break, 15% instead of up to 45%. Many, even a few financial leaders such as Warren Buffett, viewed this as so egregiously inequitable that an opposition movement has formed against it. Because of America's international reach and power, the revolving door to the financial community is a phenomenon with global consequences. It is no accident that this group is broadly predisposed to policy prescriptions such as open borders, less regulation, and lower taxes. It also favors debt restructurings and bailouts for bad loans, as in the cases of the Brady Plan after the Latin debt crisis of the 1980s and U.S. intervention to avert financial catastrophe in Mexico during the tequila crisis of late 1994 and 1995. In many respects, this is not simply because one group influences another. It is because there is only one group, with its individual members moving from one set of jobs to another. Given that this group is globally sophisticated, well-educated, intelligent, and successful by any measure, it is not surprising that much of what they advocate is also smart and worth implementing. But where is the counterweight in the system? Where is the oversight that is democracy's due to the many who are affected by these decisions, such as the taxpayers who must foot the bill for bailouts or pick up the slack created by corporate tax breaks for rich investors in private equity firms? It is hard to imagine the role of supervisor being played by a Congress that for the most part understands neither finance nor the global scene. And it will clearly not go to an executive branch that draws on this closed community for most of its top decision makers. As Thomas Friedman said to me one afternoon in his office just 2 blocks from the White House, here, now, the asymmetry in knowledge about how the global economy works between legislators and business people and technologists is as wide as the Atlantic Ocean. That is, how many legislators have you met who you think have anywhere near the grasp that you or the average multinational CEO does today about how the world works? So these national governments have a problem. How can you regulate something you do not understand? And what is more complex than the inner workings of the global economy? And if the government can't do it, it's only natural that the business community steps in. Whether that is what was originally intended, or whether that is in everyone's best interests, is a matter open for debate. Gangsters for Capitalism? As Kevin Phillips chronicles in his book, Wealth and Democracy, A Political History of the American Rich, money is the lifeblood of American politics. The interests of the moneyed have always played a great role in setting the American political agenda and influencing the behavior of presidents and all those around them. Phillips describes how the rich have shaped policy throughout U.S. history, from the great profits enjoyed by American corporations as a result of wars they supported, share prices increased 10 or even 20 times for some war suppliers during World War I, to the wealth held by top officials, like the 10 members of Warren Harding's cabinet, who were collectively worth more than $600 million. He cites Franklin Roosevelt's observations in a letter to one of Woodrow Wilson's top advisors. The real truth is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson, and I am not wholly accepting the administration of W.W. A similar concern about the connections between money and power was expressed almost simultaneously by Major General Smedley D. Butler, 2-time recipient of America's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor, and one of the most outspoken iconoclasts in U.S. military history. Popular with pacifist and anti-fascist groups in his day, Butler's comments might be lost to history were they not so resonant with similar critiques that are heard today. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active service in the country's most agile military force, the Marines. I served in all ranks from second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. Thus, I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenue in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. The record of racketeering is long. I helped purify Nicaragua for the benefit of the banking house of Brown Brothers and Company in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for American fruit companies in 1903. In China, in 1927, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. Such connections exist to this day. Butler's testimony echoes arguments of current vintage that both of our recent Gulf Wars have been fought for the benefit of oil companies to ensure that production remained uninterrupted and that threats to it were offset. These interventions have produced other beneficiaries who turn out to have considerable influence, like federal contractors such as the company once led by Vice President Cheney, Halliburton. In a similar way, during the Clinton and prior Bush eras, many pointed out that the financial bailouts associated with the emerging markets crash of 1997-98, with the tequila crisis, and with the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s and early 90s greatly benefited the Wall Street colleagues and friends of Robert Rubin and Nicholas Brady, who also happened to be among the core groups they consulted in arriving at their decisions. Yes, these interventions also had important macroeconomic benefits, and the consequences of failing to undertake them would have been severe. But in such cases, political and economic elites are so intertwined that it is hard not to see elements of self-dealing. Compounding this phenomenon is the fact that, to a much greater extent than in most other countries where political campaigns are publicly financed, America's system of campaign finance has what can only be described as a corrupting effect, making politicians dependent first on donors and only secondarily on voters at large. This, in turn, gives a special advantage to those who run large institutions and can use those positions, resources, and networks to play leading roles as fundraisers. This has never been truer than today, when the leading candidates running for president in 2008 have had to raise more than $100 million each. The financial hurdles to the highest office in the United States are so high that it is inconceivable that one could surmount them without rich and powerful allies from both the private and the public sectors. Having established lists and mechanisms and networks of fundraisers at her disposal made it easier for Senator Hillary Clinton to pick up where Bill Clinton's fundraising team left off. Having access to donors like Vinod Gupta also helps. Gupta, head of tech firm InfoUSA, reportedly had his firm provide $900,000 worth of travel to Europe, the Caribbean, and Mexico for both President and Senator Clinton. The firm also gave a $3.3 million consulting contract to Bill Clinton and a big six-figure donation to his presidential library. All this data became public thanks to a lawsuit by disgruntled InfoUSA shareholders who didn't think such largesse was in the company's financial interest. Gupta also underwrote a $1 million turn of the millennium party on the Washington Mall, a $250,000 donation to the Clinton Foundation, and more than $200,000 to the Democratic Party during Hillary Clinton's last Senate campaign. When asked what they got in return, besides the close relationship between Gupta and the Clintons, a spokesperson for the firm said, "There is just the obvious value of having a former president on your team and at your disposal for advice." The Clinton experience is not unique. The biggest donor to the campaign and early presidency of George W. Bush was the Enron Corporation, the infamous Houston-based energy company that collapsed into bankruptcy in late 2001. Enron's law firm, Vinson and Elkins, was number two, and their combined donations totaled well into the seven figures. Enron's accounting firm, Anderson Worldwide, was fourth. The top 10 donors to Bush's 2004 campaign, all with an excess of $300,000 in donations from their PACs or individual employees and their families: Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, PricewaterhouseCoopers, UBS Americas, Goldman Sachs, MBNA Corporation, Credit Suisse Group, Lehman Brothers, Citigroup, and Bear Stearns. What do the donors get in exchange? Access to senior officials, positions on presidential councils, top appointments for friends who share their views, seats on trade missions, interventions by U.S. officials to tailor elements of global regulations and tariff structures to meet the needs of specific industries, whether through the WTO, via bilateral agreements, or through other channels, efforts to enforce intellectual property concerns, and, from time to time, efforts to help play down conflicts that might threaten corporate interests. This happens often with China, for example, when brewing political tensions produce efforts from companies like Boeing or Motorola or Citibank with large interests in that country to avert the kind of crisis or trade sanctions that would be most costly to them. Kevin Phillips, in Assaying the Corrosive Effect of Money on American Politics and Ideals, quotes former Senator Bill Bradley, who, while running for president in 2000, asserted that one reason money was too intertwined with politics was the result of a failure to understand that democracy and capitalism are separate parts of the American dream, and that keeping that dream alive depends on keeping one from corrupting the other. One of the most serious consequences of this phenomenon has been the conflation of free markets and democracy in America's policy prescription for the world. The two ideas are often seen as one and the same, yet there are countless examples today of countries in which markets are getting freer, but democracy is suffering. China comes to mind, as does Russia, as does most of the Middle East. In each of these places, business interests are happy to ignore the political plight of locals, provided that returns can be earned. Advancing free markets is good and helps promote positive changes within society, and there are certainly challenges associated with the effective promotion of democracy. But failing to adequately address those challenges results, as we have seen, in the concentration of wealth and power among a few who, in turn, act in their own interests, as markets would expect them to do, without the counterbalances good governance would require. The rules change, but the game stays the same. Political elites worldwide. The connection between money and political elites has existed for centuries. Phillips notes that of 50 people cited by the Wall Street Journal as the wealthiest of the past millennium, 30 were rulers or major government officials, and another 9 were bankers or agents to governments. Perhaps even more evocatively, Cullen Murphy's book, Are We Rome? The Fall of an Empire and the Fate of America, recounts the evolution of the Latin word suffragium over 5 centuries of Rome's ascendancy and decline. According to the analysis of the Oxford historian Geoffrey de St. Croix, the word originally meant voting tablet or ballot, but over the years, as republican traditions faded and the system became one of transactions among networks of established elites, the word evolved to mean pressure that could be exerted on one's behalf by a powerful man. Ultimately, as money became the means of leverage, the term came to mean a gift, a payment, or a bribe. When Silvio Berlusconi ended his first term as Prime Minister of Italy in 1994, the country was rocked by a scandal that echoed back to the ancient language of its capital. Pundits called the debacle Tangentopoli, Bribesville. But it was not enough to stop the political career of Berlusconi, then Italy's richest man and number 14 on the Forbes billionaire list, from returning to office in 2001. He was re-elected by virtue of his drive, his outsized personality, and, not in small part, his ability to harness the power of certain of his holdings, which included a media empire that spanned 3 television networks, a film company, and Italy's biggest publishing group. Many of the current or former employees of these companies actually entered politics, joining Berlusconi's party. But more significant was the coverage that they gave the politician on his quest to return to office. According to independent calculations, during his run for office, Berlusconi's Mediaset television networks devoted 11 times more coverage to their principal owner than to his opponent. Italia One, one of those networks, tuned its coverage to the anti-crime, anti-immigrant themes that were central to Berlusconi's campaign. When Canale 5, the least biased of his holdings, cited a Berlusconi blunder, Berlusconi personally called Enrico Mentana, its news chief, and complained about the story. His Panorama magazine supported his campaign, as did the family newspaper, Il Giornale, run by Berlusconi's brother. On the verge of his election, The Guardian called his control of these media assets the biggest conflict of interest in Western democracy. Given his holdings and the state's ownership of the other three main television networks, Berlusconi would effectively have control of virtually all the significant broadcast assets in the sixth largest of the world's economies. Berlusconi brushed off the concerns about his wealth with panache, arguing that not only did the country need his entrepreneurial skills, but that his decision to serve as prime minister was in fact a sacrifice. "No, look, excuse me, but I have worked my entire life. I am doing the country a favor. I don't need to go into office for the power. I have houses all over the world, stupendous boats, including Murdoch's yacht, which I just bought. I have beautiful airplanes, a beautiful wife, a beautiful family." 5 years later, he undoubtedly felt even more sincerely that he had made a sacrifice when he was driven from office amid a swirl of scandal and accusations that he had misused his political power to protect himself from prosecution. Berlusconi's empire and networks, including his chief operating officer who hailed from Morgan Stanley, could not keep him in office, thus suggesting the limits of even extraordinary wealth. Apparently, even his business acumen could not help him in running the country, indicating the difference in skill sets required for elites in business and politics. He had done himself too much damage through alienating the business community that might have seemed a natural ally. Italy's economy faltered under his leadership, and his quick temper and knack for producing comments that put off many in Europe's leadership. He once compared a German member of the European Parliament to the boss of a concentration camp, made it easy for his opponents ultimately to bring him down. So too did rumors of scandal and self-dealing that remain unresolved to this day. Berlusconi was a trailblazer in another area, crafting a stance that bridged the difference between nationalism and internationalism. He was pro-America, a supporter of Bush's efforts in the Middle East, for example, and pro-globalization, yet anti-immigration and combative with his European colleagues. It is a stance others would emulate in response to a growing political divide in Europe and elsewhere, the increasing tension between nationalist and internationalist factions in society. For the most part, business is pro-internationalist, following capital flows and cheap labor. Labor is more nationalist, threatened especially by immigration and trade deals that might lead to the loss of jobs. Berlusconi's position was roughly in the middle, the center of this new continuum. Another who has taken a similar approach is French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who ran for office on his record of being tough on security, tough on immigration, and tough on parallel concerns, like keeping Turkey out of the EU. Yet he is also pro-Europe, and more pro-United States and pro-Israel than any French leader in the recent past. The connections between Sarkozy and leaders of the business and media communities run deep, extending back to his days as mayor of the upscale Parisian suburb of Neuilly-sur-Seine, and they have been carefully cultivated throughout his climb to the top of the French political scene. Sarkozy developed particularly close relationships with a number of media magnates, which were important in helping him defeat socialist candidate Ségolène Royal for the presidency. Many of the ties are practically familial. Martin Bouygues, CEO of a global conglomerate that owns the leading French TV network, is a godfather to Sarkozy's young son, while Arnaud Lagardère, the head of a military contractor and media company that owns a number of newspapers and radio outlets, calls Sarkozy a brother. Bernard Arnault, a billionaire and the chairman and CEO of Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton, which owns the daily business journal La Tribune, attended Sarkozy's wedding. And shortly after France's 2007 presidential elections, the victorious president-elect Sarkozy decompressed for a few days on the yacht of his friend and supporter, billionaire Vincent Bolloré. Bolloré's enterprise, which today has annual sales in excess of $8 billion, includes interests in advertising, transportation, energy, and a number of media outlets. A reporter for Le Monde recalled that after one of Sarkozy's campaign rallies, the candidate remarked to a group of journalists, "It's funny, I know all your bosses." Sarkozy breaks the mold of government leaders in France in several important ways. Not only is he the first French president whose father was not born in France, he was Hungarian, he is also the first born since the end of World War II. He also, due to an undistinguished early academic career, was unable to gain admittance to France's school for future political leaders, the École Nationale d'Administration, ENA. Working his way around that obstacle was formidable. As one French CEO told me, "We have a tradition of celebrating égalité, but in France, everybody is equal only up until high school. Then, when you get into high school, you start getting diverted into programs that lead you into the specialized universities, which, as with the ENA, are usually the only way to the top. But Sarkozy did it the only other available way. He worked his way into the hearts of the elites who did go to those schools, by being loyal and tough and hard-working. He has a great way with people he wants help from." Sarkozy skillfully did what political elites must do in a party system: gain favor with the controlling business and political elites, work those relationships hard, and improvise where necessary. It is a pattern seen in virtually all members of the political superclass, and indeed in most members of the superclass who seek to rise up in the context of established institutional hierarchies, whether parties, companies, religious organizations, or crime families. Performance is key, too. On his path from mayor to member of parliament to gaining right-wing leader Jacques Chirac's patronage and becoming budget minister to being appointed spokesman for the party, the wiry and intense Sarkozy did what needed to be done to get ahead. Truly, he tried almost everything, including dating Chirac's daughter. When his advancement was going too slowly and he took another path, backing a rival of Chirac, he stumbled. But in stumbling was forced to reinvent himself and reshape the modern French right wing. Regaining his footing and repairing his relationship with Chirac, Sarkozy became interior minister in Chirac's 2002 government, and thus was able to help the Gaullists offer a conservative alternative to the hard right policies of Jean-Marie Le Pen. He was the minister in charge when immigrant groups, feeling left out of the French economy, rioted in 2005. Using his media ties and skills and a boldness that was new to French politics, he promised to put an end to the problem by washing the scum out of the ghettos with an industrial power hose. He played on the French national unease with the influx of immigrants, mostly from northern Africa, and, in borrowing that stance from Le Pen, co-opted him, ultimately ensuring his victory over Royal. Since election, Sarkozy has zigged back a little to the center, choosing to appoint a cabinet that is half-female, and picking as his foreign minister Bernard Kouchner, a darling of the left and co-founder of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. In so doing, he revealed his recognition of the importance of image and the media in modern politics, his flair for the dramatic, and his awareness of the growing political relevance of non-traditional groups like NGOs. These moves were all as innovative as his tough stance against immigrants was not. At a time when EU expansion and globalization are raising questions about European identity, especially with regard to the admission of Turkey, it is not a little ironic that one of the most prominent leaders of Europe has Hungarian roots. After all, it was control of Hungary and rivalry with the Austro-Hungarian Empire that was at the center of the last Ottoman Turkish invasion into the heart of Europe, culminating in 1683 in the Battle of Vienna. Those conflicts underscore that politicians and policies may change, but proximity and geography do not, and that, for Europe, the clash of civilizations with the Islamic world will always be a more pressing issue than for even the United States. This explains the intensity of intolerance there, the Danish cartoon controversy being such a powerful example, and why the new European nationalism of Sarkozy has such deep and ugly roots. It is a fascinating paradox. Pan-Europeanism looks very modern and anti-nationalist, but for many in Europe, it is also anti-globalist regionalism, a desire to preserve what is seen as European and to assert Europe's role in the context of a world that would make it much harder for individual states acting alone to do so. This tension between internationalism and nationalism has become a defining issue for the global political superclass during its emergence over the past several decades. Evolving international structures, such as the official mechanisms of multilateralism, the UN, the international financial institutions, alliances, and working groups from NATO to the G8 to the G20, and the informal ones, clusters of bankers practicing self-regulation or public-private partnerships grappling with issues like AIDS, and long-established national institutions are all struggling to define their roles in the global era. There is a recognition that national political institutions, traditions, and cultures are ill-suited to the exigencies of the new reality. At the same time, the day-to-day track for aspiring political elites requires working the national system, starting in the right place, gaining the favor of local higher-ups, finding a mentor, and landing key posts under his or sometimes her guidance. Interestingly, in this respect, the political superclass operates for the most part, except for insurgents and coup plotters, in a much more closed system than does the business and financial superclass, largely because each national system typically has only a couple of party apparatuses in which to successfully function. All the incentives to gain political power lie in a domestic system, but once in power, leaders discover an unsettling reality. Many of the most vital issues with which they must deal, like those that are or have been on the front burner for Sarkozy, Berlusconi, and Bush, as well as leaders in the developing world, are international in origin and require international solutions. Achieving domestic results will require working outside the domestic system. Those who recognize the merits of international collaboration become the globalists. Those who resist it, often in order to be perceived as champions of local interests, are the nationalists. The nationalists frame compromises that are necessary for collaboration as dilutions of sovereignty, whereas the internationalists see them as essential to preserving national well-being in the global era. Nationalists seek to preserve the power of closed domestic political systems in a world of increasingly open economic systems. These tensions and divides are increasingly defining the global political landscape. For many of today's political leaders, the solution is to walk a tightrope to the top, remaining loyal to national political systems while teasing out international gains that sometimes threaten national prerogatives. Perhaps no one faces as difficult a challenge in this regard as Chinese President Hu Jintao. Born in 1942, another leader who is a child of the post-World War II era, who grew up in a merchant family in the city of Taizhou. He was, according to his family, an obedient child who did well enough at school to gain a spot at Tsinghua University, where he earned a degree in engineering. As Bill Gates once pointed out, many Chinese leaders have earned degrees in engineering, a favored pursuit under the communist regime, which has made it possible for people like Gates to be able to speak to them about scientific matters and appreciate their greater understanding than might be found in capitals like Washington, where the political elite is still dominated by lawyers. By the time he left college, he had become a member of the Communist Party, and during the early part of his career, he was working with the patronage of a party official named Song Ping, who had been tasked with identifying next-generation leaders. By the early 1980s, his discipline had earned Hu a position atop the Communist Youth League, where he did well enough to win the approval and support of the General Secretary of the Communist Party, Hu Yaobang, no relation. The elder Hu accelerated the career of the future president, engineering his appointment at 39 to the party's Central Committee, and at 42 to the position of Provincial Party Secretary, achievements that had never before been offered to anyone so young. In the latter role, Hu displayed a particular gift that resonates with the gifts of other political elites we have considered thus far. Like compassionate conservative Bush and nationalist internationalists like Sarkozy and Berlusconi, he was able to shape a persona in which he was perceived as different things by different people. As party secretary in Guizhou, he fostered an atmosphere that embraced intellectual diversity and seemed flexible and more open to ideas of reform. When he moved on from there to Tibet, where he oversaw the province at a time of pro-Dalai Lama protests in the streets of Lhasa, he showed his willingness to use force to eliminate the threat to Beijing's rule. His work in Tibet from 1989 to 1992 earned him appreciation in the inner sanctums of the Communist Party, the one electorate that matters in the Chinese system, and he was named a member of the Politburo Standing Committee. Just 6 years later, in 1998, Jiang Zemin named him vice president and therefore positioned him as his most likely successor. Hu was not only able to appear both progressive and tough to the elders leading the party, he was also seen as a voice of the future and built a strong following among other members of his own generation. This balancing act, which led to his assumption of the presidency in 2002, has obviously been followed by many other, tougher ones, balancing China's voracious need for growth with its simultaneous desire for stability, the dynamism of its cities and coastal regions with the poverty of its rural areas, its dependency on outside capital and trade with its desire to remain in control of its own destiny, its impulse to be a global power with its desire to preserve a Chinese national identity, rampant capitalism with the desire to maintain elements of the communist system. Hu has summed up his core approach to these challenges with the phrase, harmonious society, which uses a traditional Chinese virtue to frame his plan for addressing the inequalities that remain the greatest perceived threat to the country's internal cohesion. He has sought to promote some modest levels of democratic innovation at local levels in Chinese society, while simultaneously sending a strong message that the country remains committed to one-party rule and the central role of the Communist Party. In this approach, there is either something for everyone or something to inflame every critic. It's a fine line, and how well it works will be seen largely in a dimension of Hu's performance that is hard to gauge now. His role as the leader of the party elite, the elders, who will select the generation of leaders they intend to succeed them. Behind the scenes, the globalization of the smoke-filled back room. Less visible than prime ministers, presidents, leading legislators, and foreign ministers among the global political superclass are those who make them possible, advise them, polish their rhetoric, spin their positions. In the past, perhaps few professions were so parochialized by the "all politics is local" observation of former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. But today, the proverbial smoke-filled back room has itself become globalized with a handful of top political consultants advising leaders and aspirants around the world. They bring with them polling techniques, television marketing strategies, opposition research approaches, and a host of other tools that are starting to make elections worldwide look more similar. In so doing, they are also building ties between political parties in different countries, between their leaders, and between their ideologies, ties that are slowly creating something like global political coalitions. While the communist parties of the mid-20th century may have been trailblazers in this regard, they were hampered by a deeply flawed product and generally lousy strategies. When you're forced to win hearts and minds at gunpoint, it suggests that your message may need a little more work. Instead, the real breakthroughs in the 1990s were led by consultants and parties from the United States and Britain, whose efforts quickly extended out beyond that traditional English language axis to help fledgling candidates in the former Soviet bloc throughout Europe and Latin America and on into Asia and Africa. The consequence is a group that complements in influence those with money, one that offers the words and the techniques that resonate with voters worldwide, that transfers lessons from one country to another, and is collectively responsible for either the dumbing down of global political discourse, the enhanced sophistication of global political campaigning, or, as it seems likely, both. As early as the 1930s, American pollster George Gallup traveled to Britain to promote his polling abilities, and throughout the second half of the 20th century, British politicians were visiting the United States to observe political campaigns and discuss strategy with their counterparts. Thatcher and Reagan's rapport extended to a discussion of managing their political situations, and Thatcher's successor, John Major, introduced U.S.-style presidential debates to Britain. Perhaps unfortunately for Major, his opponent in the 1997 election, in which such debates were introduced, was Tony Blair, who had dedicated himself to finding a new voice for the Labour Party and the new campaign technologies to go with it. The authors of New Labour turned to the group that had invented New Democrats in the United States, Bill Clinton and the small cadre of political consultants closest to him. Some already had established networks, such as Philip Gould, who had worked with the top Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg and his collaborator and friend James Carville, the colorful, sharp-tongued Louisiana native made famous as Bill Clinton's political guru in 1992. Gould has written, "I was not a lone voice for Clinton within Labour. Margaret McDonough, Hon Braggins, and Alan Barnard, who were to hold senior positions in the 1997 election campaign, were all working in one capacity or another for Clinton. Jonathan Powell, then working for the British Embassy in Washington, now Tony Blair's chief of staff, was observing the Clinton campaign at first hand and building links that were later to prove priceless. Out of all this was born Milbank Tower, Labour Party headquarters, and the war room it houses, Rapid Rebuttal and the Excalibur computer used to monitor opposition communications, an obsession with message, and a tough, unremitting focus on hard-working people and their concerns. At the time, the message of Little Rock was not heard, but it could not be silenced. The Clinton experience was seminal for the Labour Party. Within 5 years, almost everything that was written in my document had been implemented. Modernization of labor did not depend on Clinton, it would have happened anyway, but his election did give modernization a roadmap." Today, Gould is revered within political circles on both sides of the Atlantic as one of the players most instrumental in the creation of New Labor. "He is a legend," says Anita Dunn of Squire Knapp Dunn, a top U.S. political consultancy. Dunn, who is one of the most thoughtful and highly regarded members of her profession's elite, went on to note that while the globalization of political consulting is a powerful phenomenon, it is primarily one that has been pioneered and dominated by top Americans, including Republicans like Frank Luntz, John McLaughlin, Richard Werthelin, and her Democratic colleagues Greenberg, Carville, and Mark Penn, the chairman of Burson Marsteller and the chief strategist for the presidential campaign of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Gould is in a class by himself among non-U.S. practitioners of the profession. "I think," Dunn said, "he is the only non-American political consultant who could successfully come to the United States, which, after all, is the home of this sort of practice, and be a major success here." Dunn herself recounted a conversation with representatives of a European Social Democratic Party who were concerned that their candidate would not be able to hold his own in an upcoming presidential debate. They wanted to hire some pros to help him with his debate prep, another term like war room, rapid response or rapid rebuttal, and opposition research that has made its way from the world of American polls to the world at large. Stanley Greenberg, whose firm Greenberg Quinlan Rossner has worked on dozens of international campaigns, cites among his most prominent clients Bill Clinton, Nelson Mandela, Thabo Mbeki, Tony Blair, Ehud Barak, and Gerhard Schroeder. In the connections among some of these is seen one fledgling trend that may gather momentum as such consultants and those associated with them fan out into an expanding network across the globe. Clinton, Blair, and Schroeder were all new voices for their center-left parties, and an effort was made among them to remain in touch, forming a kind of global third-way alliance. At times, this was joined by others, such as the Dutch Prime Minister Wim Kok and Italy's Prime Minister Massimo De Lema, who joined the group at a meeting convened in Washington in the spring of 1999 by the Democratic Leadership Council, a centralist political organization that was closely associated with Clinton. The dialogue that produced this meeting was actually the result of a conversation that Blair had with First Lady Hillary Clinton a couple of years earlier. Together, these leaders discussed commonalities in their message and the extent to which their views were taking hold from Latin America to Australia, and they sought to translate disparate parties into a more coordinated effort. While the defeat of Al Gore in 2000 derailed the effort by removing its most prominent member, the ties remain, especially along the Washington-London axis, and via which British Prime Minister Gordon Brown retains close relationships with many ideologically sympathetic counterparts in the United States. Another dimension of these global political networks is that political consultants do not work exclusively for political parties. Greenberg, for example, also derives a substantial portion of his firm's revenues from private sector organizations, including Boeing, BP, British Airways, Sun Microsystems, Monsanto, United Healthcare, the Business Roundtable, and the Organization for International Investment. Mark Penn oversees a PR business that lists among its clients Ford, Merck, Verizon, BP, McDonald's, and Microsoft. According to the firm's website, Penn has helped to elect over 25 leaders in the United States, Asia, Latin America, and Europe. Among the most prominent of these was his successful work in helping Tony Blair win a third term as Britain's Prime Minister. In fact, as great as his reputation is for serving as the pollster for the Clintons, he has also earned a reputation in the business community as brilliant and exceptionally creative for his work on corporate campaigns, including helping Microsoft shed its reputation as a corporate bully. Critics, such as competing pollster Mark Blumenthal, have suggested that Penn and his firm have displayed a thirst for corporate work, often in conflict with the policy agendas of their political clients, that has long set the bar among Democratic pollsters. Among Democrats, Penn is seen as a particularly strong advocate for business views, but the conflict exists for virtually all consultants. One senior Democratic official called the accusation, perhaps one part truth and one big part sour grapes, because Mark is the king of the hill right now. Despite their corporate ties, these consultants typically seem more like rumpled academics. Greenberg, who got his Ph.D. at Harvard and is married to Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, has an intense but cerebral mien, with a good sense of humor and an uncanny knack for seeing the core issues at play in a political contest. He is an author and has worked for a wide variety of NGOs and not-for-profits, including the campaign to ban landmines. Penn, who also studied at Harvard, often appears in his jeans while hosting high-level Washington soirees at his Georgetown townhouse. He, too, is married to an influential woman, Nancy Jacobson, one of the Democratic Party's top fundraisers. He is an author and widely sought-after commentator, and is known to those within the campaigns he has advised as a guy whose brain is often working so fast that he leaves some of his listeners in the dust. He has worked exceptionally closely with the Clintons, who highly value what one person in their inner circle calls his special genius. In fact, he was booted out as an advisor to Vice President Al Gore's presidential campaign in 2000 when, in response to Gore's question about whether there was any sign of Clinton fatigue, Penn quipped, "I'm not tired of him. Are you?" Gore's other advisors, who worried that Penn was too close to the Clintons, pressed for and secured his removal. Gore went on to run his campaign, distancing himself from Clinton, and in retrospect, Democratic insiders believe he did himself in, losing the lift Clinton could have provided and the resulting votes that might have given him the edge in the close election with George W. Bush. Tangled webs and tottering institutions. Fulfilling the international and domestic obligations of their jobs is another difficult balancing act members of the political superclass must manage. This challenge is made greater by the fact that the formal mechanisms with which they must work internationally are so weak, some so ill-formed or imbalanced, that they must search for new ones or pursue informal approaches. This is hardly new. International interaction has always been an important part of affairs of state. The difference today lies in the degree to which global markets have created codependent relationships between governments and investors, and the degree to which public sector control of key assets, of their currency, of their borders, of their culture, is eroding. Beyond these factors is a growing awareness of the importance of transnational issues, whether they pertain to global warming, terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, trafficking in drugs or people or counterfeit money, or pandemics and other global health risks, to name but a few. It would be a comfort were leaders able to turn to global institutions as forums in which these issues could effectively be addressed. But most such institutions are rickety relics of a 60-year-old world view, a product of the way the planet looked at the end of World War II, or of the dynamics that shaped it during the Cold War era. And most have failed to adapt well as circumstances have changed. Today, the World Bank and the IMF are embroiled in serious debates about their futures, about voting structures that give disproportionate power to the United States and Europe, and even about the viability of their business models. Regional development banks, such as the Inter-American Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, are also scrambling to adapt to a world in which most capital flows are from the private sector, and governments are increasingly less inclined to borrow or follow the prescriptions of international advisors whose formulas have proved to bring only mixed results at best. The UN has been racked by scandal. The General Assembly is widely considered to be unwieldy and seldom productive. The Security Council, while occasionally effective, gives special place to five countries because they happened to win a war that was a lifetime ago. And many of the UN's component agencies are seen as failing to deliver the services they are intended to provide. Senior IMF officials have been preoccupied in recent years with internal and external debates about the future role and relevance of the fund. In 2007, a group of eminent world citizens were asked to make recommendations about the future, but they steered clear of issues like the IMF voting structure, which gives the United States almost 20% of the votes, even though it is now no longer a net donor nation, but gives China, the country with the world's largest reserves, less than 4% of the vote. They didn't deal with the fact that, by tradition, European countries get to choose the leader of the IMF. The IMF managing director through most of 2007 was Rodrigo Rato, formerly Spain's finance minister. And the Americans choose the president of the World Bank. These facts are galling to much of the rest of the world, particularly the countries that have traditionally been the IMF's biggest borrowers and the ones that have had to follow politically unpopular prescriptions in order to win IMF funds. According to Rato and his colleagues, there are even bigger issues at stake. The IMF has traditionally sustained itself by lending money to governments and getting paid back the money plus interest. In 2002, its loan portfolio was more than $100 billion. By mid-2007, following a backlash against the fund led by countries like Argentina, who simply decided they did not want to dance the IMF's tune anymore, the IMF has a loan portfolio of only $13 billion. It will soon fall further when Turkey pays off its $8 billion debt. So the gray eminences of the fund were turning their attention to how to generate enough cash to keep the fund afloat. One possibility they considered was the liquidation of some of the IMF's gold reserves, the second largest reserves of gold anywhere in the world. Reinvesting that money could provide funds to sustain the institution. To do what? To continue providing advice to countries, to help regulate global financial flows, to anticipate and relieve problems. "It is still a vital role," noted Ratto, "and we are the only ones who are in a position to play it." But there is a broader question of whether countries will continue to authorize funding. The distance between the fund's Washington offices and Capitol Hill is a long way. Prodded for examples of what the fund was doing well that might resonate with Congress, Ratto suggested that the fund's work in Iraq had been a big success and that financially the country was working better than ever. While this may be so, it showed a remarkable insensitivity to the interests or inclinations of a newly democratic Congress. The IMF is viewed with skepticism by many on Capitol Hill as a money sink that provides funding to countries that end up hating the United States no matter what we do to help. It is viewed as a threat to sovereignty, a mechanism of much-feared world government, and as hopelessly inefficient. Abroad, the World Bank and IMF are viewed with hostility because their programs are seen as insensitive, draconian, or supportive of the interests of the United States, Europe, Wall Street, or big business. During the 1997-98 emerging markets crisis, protesters in streets from Sao Paulo to Seoul decried them. One evocative poster in Brazil read, "IMF, International Motherfuckers." The fund's leaders have clearly been frustrated. Ratto himself resigned his post early, citing family circumstances. The organization had an important function. As the only mechanism able to coordinate government policies, it would in fact be vital in a time of global financial crisis. But change was needed. Today, given the shift in capital flows and the fact that the sea of private capital has vastly overtaken in importance the sporadic bursts of government capital that once could move markets to help achieve IMF goals, the fund requires collaboration with an informal network of private financial institutions to do its job. "It works differently today," said Robert Rubin. "In financial crises, there is a critical role to play for the fund. But we also had to work systematically on the phone with the banks to try to induce people to a standstill mode, or whatever we were seeking. We had to create, for each situation we faced, a kind of ad hoc structure built around the combination of the IMF, the Treasury, and the financial community. That's what we did." In short, an informal cluster of political leaders and private sector leaders, bringing together national and international actors, had to be manufactured on the fly to respond to the specific needs of specific challenges. While this approach offers flexibility and is manageable because of its invitation-only nature, it is also not representative of broader global interests and suffers a bit from the learning curve problems associated with any ad hoc approach. Luis Alberto Moreno, president of the Inter-American Development Bank, faces similar challenges with his institution, which is now almost 50 years old. "The countries of the region are less inclined to borrow, the old business model doesn't work, and financial markets are driving capital flows to the region and setting the rules. The Americans have seen vastly increased flows of remittances, cash sent from family members in the United States back to their relatives in Mexico, Central America, or elsewhere in the hemisphere. These flows now exceed $50 billion a year. They are vastly more important to regional growth and development than the roughly $6 billion a year lent by the IDB. The bank may also soon face competition from a proposed Bank of the South that Chavez wants to establish as an alternative lending source for South Americans, one that is more on his terms and less on those of the United States. The rules and goals of such a bank would likely create further headaches for the IDB. All the multilateral development banks are facing similar challenges, Moreno said. It is important we realize that our system of international financial institutions is really at a turning point. It may not be the number one issue in many countries, but if we don't address it, millions of people, billions, will suffer. James Wolfenson, former Wall Street superstar and later president of the World Bank, observed to me, "I don't write off institutions like the bank or the fund or the family of international financial institutions, but there is no question that the weight they bear is much less than it was, and that the world has changed much more than they have." Like others, Wolfenson sees the ownership and management structures of these institutions as a problem. "There's absolutely no question this is an issue," he said. "It's true with the UN. It's true with the World Bank. We have two directors on the bank's board for 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, out of 24 directors overall, even though they make up a huge percentage of the bank's focus. I think the institutions have not changed with the world. I remember going 7 or 8 years ago to a G7 meeting. It was the first time they had asked Jiang Zemin, as then the president of China, to attend. There were 6 or 7 large developing countries there, and I believe the Brazilian president stood up and he said how proud he was to be among all these famous men, and then he suggested that maybe the following year the meeting should be in Rio because there were so many more people in the developing world, and that within 40 years they would represent 40% of the world GDP, and it would be nice to have more of a say in what is going on. And I thought it was both funny and extremely valid, because global institutions have not adjusted to the changes around them, and in particular the United States and Europeans have not adjusted. And they still think that the core group is the G7, or the G8 if the Russians are lucky enough to be invited, and that the notion of having China or India, two countries with a third of the world's population between them, two of the fastest growing economies in the world, is just too exotic for them to take on. Wolfenson is back in the private sector now, operating from a small suite of offices in Midtown Manhattan. He spends his time working for a small group of clients, pursuing his interests in the arts, an accomplished cellist he was for many years the chairman of Carnegie Hall, and advising on international issues, as he did when he served as an emissary for the quartet in talks between Israel and the Palestinians. He is a kind of prototypical superclass member, qualified for the group by virtue of his achievements in the private sector, the public sector, and the arts. When the subject turns to the relevance of global institutions, his intensity and frustration are palpable. It is true for literally all with whom I have spoken about these institutions. They acknowledge that there is a central mission, a vital need for them to address issues of poverty and inequality, of global financial market management and shaping policies. But change comes rarely and slowly, and they worry that these institutions are becoming less relevant at a time when they are needed most, and that there is little will to take up the difficult work of reinventing them. Making them more effective will cut to core questions of ownership, of the international pecking order among nations, and of sovereignty, of effectively ceding sovereignty to these mechanisms of world governance when sovereignty remains the third rail in national politics worldwide.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.